Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, March 13, 2025, and our friend Scott Rader is back with us. Welcome back, Scott.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Let's get started, Scott, with the new agreement between the Trump administration and Ukrainians. And here is what Donald Trump said about that.
A lot of things, obviously, we'll be discussing what's happening with respect to Ukraine and Russia. At this moment, we have people talking in Russia. We have representatives over there, Steve Witkoff and others, and they're in very serious discussions. As you know, Ukraine has agreed, subject to this, what's happening today, to a complete ceasefire, and we hope Russia will do the same. Thousands of people are being killed, young people, usually, mostly. Young people, we're just talking about it. Thousands of young people are being killed a week, and we want to see that stop. And they're not Americans, and they're not from the Netherlands for the most part.
No.
They're not from, they're from Russia and they're from Ukraine, but they're people. And I think everybody feels the same way. We want it to stop. It's also a tremendous cost to the United States and to other countries. And it's something that would have never happened if I were president, and it makes me very angry to see that it did happen. But it happened, and we have to stop it. And Mark has done.
Here is what he said, Scott. And many people are arguing why, what's the main reason of talking about ceasefire while they're knowing that the, both parties, Ukrainians and Russians, are talking about they don't want to accept a ceasefire. But it was some sort of surprise for many people that the Russian president said he responded this way.
In this situation, I think the Ukrainian side might well want to achieve at least 30 days of ceasefire. And we're in favor of that, but there are nuances, though. Number one is what we're going to do with this sector of breached state border. If we stop the hostilities for 30 days, what it's going to mean? Is that, will that mean that everybody there is going to retreat without fighting? Are we going to have to let them go after all the atrocities they have perpetrated against civilians? Or the Ukrainian leadership will command them to lower their weapons, drop their weapons and just surrender? How is it going to look? That's still unclear. And what about other issues along the entire contact line, which is almost 2,000 kilometers? And as you know, Russian troops have been advancing almost all along the contact line. And there already conditions are favorable for us to surround and encircle whole military units. How are they going to use those 30 days? Is the ceasefire going to be used to continue forced mobilization, to continue rearming, to continue supplies of weaponry? To allow military units to regroup, but if nothing like this is done, then the question is bound to arise: how is control and verification is going to go? How are we guaranteed that nothing like that ever repeats? How is it going to be controlled? I really hope common sense tells everyone how it's going to look like, what it's going to look like. Who's going to give orders to cease the hostilities? And what will be the price of those orders? Just imagine 2,000 kilometers. Who's going to determine who? Who broke the ceasefire along those 2,000 kilometers? And who's going to lay blame on others for breaking this agreement? Those are all issues that require very careful studying from both sides. So the very idea is great, I think it's correct, and we, of course, support it. There are, though, certain issues that we still need to look into and to discuss. And we need to hold consultations with our American partners, counterparts. Maybe we need to have a phone talk with President Trump to discuss that with him as well. But the very idea of ending this conflict in a peaceful manner, we support that.
He simply says that the idea is so nice to think of, but how can we implement that? The various issues that he has raised during his response. What's your take on the way that Russians are thinking of a ceasefire between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, first of all, we have to stop pretending that all this took place in a vacuum. We have to stop pretending that this narrative began in Riyadh earlier this week with a dialogue between the United States and Ukraine, and that somehow what came out of that dialogue was new and innovative and earth-shattering, and that Russia is receiving this for the first time, and that for the first time Russia is going back to the United States with its response. This is absurd in the extreme. This is a narrative that began, back during the campaign when President Trump, then a candidate Trump, was given horrible advice by his principal advisor on Ukraine, Keith Kellogg. Horrible advice. And that advice turned into policy formulations that were unrealistic, both in terms of timelines and expectations. Expectations about how Russia would respond and what America could do to bring to the table. Unfortunately, we saw that Keith Kellogg's pronouncements were embraced by the Secretary of Treasury designate, Scott Bessent, who has become the Secretary of Treasury, who has made ridiculous comments about pressure that can be put on Russia economically, comments that the President of the United States, Donald Trump, bought into and repeated. And still, in some ways, continues to articulate that this is his thinking. But a reality check came in the form of Russia just refusing to even engage. Russia wouldn't pick up the phone, wouldn't talk. And the reason why is that they rejected Keith Kellogg's formulations out of hand. This led to Steve Witkoff, who is normally the Middle East envoy, being sent to Russia on February 11th. Why? Why would Witkoff be sent there? Because Mohammed bin Salman, Saudi crown prince, who is very knowledgeable of the Russians, has worked with the Russians intensively. Russia is, after all, a member of the OPEC Plus. So they have constant discussions about not just energy security, but when you're talking energy security, you're talking regional stability. I think sometimes people forget that there is direct connectivity, that you can't have energy security. And if you're an energy producing nation like Saudi Arabia, and your economy is dependent upon the price of oil, and you make budgets based upon the price of oil, what you need is consistency and stability. And regional conflict brings the exact opposite, makes it impossible to balance a budget, makes it impossible to have anything predictable outcomes. And so Saudi Arabia is very interested in stability. And they watched Steve Witkoff come in and seize the reins of authority away from, the Biden administration when it came to the Gaza conflict. Watch how Steve Witkoff behaved and with the Israelis and with others, and was deeply impressed and understood that Steve Witkoff's authority came not from his knowledge of the Middle East. He has none. But his ability to be the vector for Donald Trump, to channel Donald Trump. He was very close with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump trusted him implicitly. And so Mohammed bin Salman called Vladimir Putin and said, "This is the guy that you need to talk to. This is the guy that can get it started." And the hint was dropped. And next thing you know, Steve Witkoff is on his way to Moscow, February 11th, to ostensibly recover a prisoner, Mark Fogel, who had been imprisoned by the Russians for a drug offense. But this wasn't just a prisoner retrieval mission, he met with Vladimir Putin. Now, let me just again, sometimes you got to explain things to people because they don't understand the significance of it. You just don't meet with the Russian president, just like you just don't meet with the American president. When you meet with heads of state of this caliber, there has to be a reason. His time is valuable. Why is he going to allocate time to Steve Witkoff to talk about Mark Vogel? Nope. It's because he wants to take advantage of Witkoff's access to Trump to receive a message and to send a message. And whatever conversation they had resonated greatly. And it wasn't just a meeting between Witkoff and Putin. Putin brought in somebody else, a name that nobody, unless you've been following Russia intimately, like me, nobody knew before this happened. How many people can honestly say that they knew who Kirill Dmitriev was? When they heard that name, most people went to Google and said, who the hell is Kirill Dmitriev? And why is he meeting with Steve Witkoff? What's the importance? Why is the head of Russia's, you know, sovereign investment fund meeting with the emissary of Donald Trump? Because they speak the language of international business, and because Dmitriev was setting Witkoff straight on the reality of the Russian economy, you know, the false expectations that Trump had about certain policy directions that could put pressure on Russia. You need to set the record straight, what can be achieved and what can't be achieved, and to talk about the potential of the economic benefits of a renewed economic relationship. This is broader than just Ukraine. In fact, the conversation appeared to discuss almost everything but Ukraine. Witkoff went back the very next day. Trump has a 90-minute phone call with Donald Trump, with Vladimir Putin. I bring this up again because if you're acting as if what we're hearing from Putin today is the first time he's considered Donald Trump's position, you're wrong. You're fundamentally wrong. He heard Donald Trump's position back on February 12th when they had a 90-minute phone call where they exchanged ideas. This phone call didn't just happen out of the blue. They were both ready for it. They both knew what they wanted to say. They said it. They listened. And then it was followed up by a meeting in Riyadh between the Secretary of State and his counterpart, the Foreign Minister of Russia. It wasn't just them. Michael Waltz, National Security Advisor, met with his counterpart, Mr. Ushakov. And Kirill Dmitriev was there too, meeting with Steve Witkoff. You had three levels of connectivity there. Very detailed exchange of ideas, broader than simply Ukraine. I bring this up because what we're seeing here is theater. That's it. This is theater. You know, Marco Rubio, when he met with the Ukrainian delegation in Riyadh earlier this week, wasn't making a final deal. Rubio knew he wasn't making a final deal. What Rubio was doing was beginning a process, but it was a process that was hampered by several things. One, by the Ukrainians themselves, who up until were refusing to, how can you talk about a negotiated settlement with Russia when the Constitution of Ukraine prohibits negotiation? I mean, this seems to be one of those stumbling blocks. And how do you proceed when, no matter what the President of the United States said, because let's just reiterate what Trump has said is some of the foundational understandings that have been reached between the United States and Russia. A, Russia didn't start this war. Whap! There goes the entire European narrative that this is a war of Russian aggression. Russia didn't start this war. Russia was right to defend its interests. These are fundamental things, guys. Previously, they've been dismissed as Kremlin talking points, but they're not. They're statements of fact, fact-based reality. Two, Ukraine will never be a member of NATO, ever. It's just not going to happen. Boom. Three, there won't be European peacekeeping forces deployed to Ukraine. Isn't going to happen. Boom. And we can go on and on. This is the reality that was set forth. Having articulate, oh, perhaps the most important, the war in Ukraine is a proxy war between the United States and Russia. Ukraine is just a proxy. That's sort of like it, the defining thing. When you have the Secretary of State articulate this, saying this is between us and Russia, we're the warring parties, Ukraine is a proxy. This is fundamental. So because when you say that, you now understand the role that Ukraine plays. They're not driving this ship. They're just the proxy. This ship is being driven by the United States. The United States started this war. The United States is the one who set the objectives of this war, which we know are the strategic defeat of Russia. And Ukraine is simply the proxy. Ironically, it's not just that this is a Kremlin talking point. I remember when I was put on the Mirtvorts death list and put on the Center for Countering Disinformation's hit list. One of the reasons why they said is that I was saying that the war is a proxy conflict between NATO and Ukraine. And that apparently is the death penalty. I'm supposed to be killed because I said that. I found it interesting, the timing of this, because about a week and a half later, the Ukrainian defense minister came out and said, oh, no, 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 this is a proxy war between NATO and Russia, and we're happy to be that. Give us more weapons, and we will serve as your proxy. Guys, this has been known from day one. Only idiots and the mainstream media, I guess they're the same, have been articulating something different. And so now we have, you know, foundational understanding of this conflict. So what is the role of Ukraine? It's an insignificant role. And we saw the way that Donald Trump treated Zelensky in the White House. Dismissive. It was an ambush, time to demean him. And there's a reason for this. What happened in Riyadh? We know Zelensky was in Riyadh. We all saw the photographs of him meeting with Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince. But the president of Ukraine, why wasn't he heading up the Ukrainian delegation? Why was the presidential advisor heading it up? Because the United States said Zelensky's not welcome at the table. Don't bother. We don't want you there. You're not part of the solution. You are the problem. So again, we have to understand all this when we bring into, you know, try and put context into the statement that Marco Rubio used to initiate everything that you're premising this show on. But there's something else that happened too, because who visited the White House prior to Zelensky's humiliation? Emmanuel Macron and Keir Starmer. And they visited the White House. They tried to articulate Europe's vision of what's going on, which wasn't, by the way, a vision predicated on a ceasefire, but a vision predicated on continuing this conflict until Russia was defeated. Again, let's just make things very clear. Europe was dead set against a ceasefire. The European posture was, we must humble Russia. Russia must be defeated so that Russia knows it can never stand up to Europe again. That's what they said. I'm not making it up. And they met to talk about 800 billion euros worth of infusion of defense funding, getting boots on the ground. The French were talking about getting their nuclear deterrence deployed into Germany, putting air cover over Ukraine. War, 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 war. And now you're Donald Trump saying, I want to bring this war to an end. If I only negotiate with the Russians without bringing in Ukraine, then we have a problem with Europe, because the strategic objective for Donald Trump here is peace and stability in Europe so the United States can disentangle itself from the European web and reallocate diplomatic, economic, and military resources to the Pacific to deal with the principal issue of China. Never forget that. Ukraine is a sideshow for what Trump wants to do with China. Not military. We talked about this before. I don't believe that Trump's looking for a war with China. I think Trump's looking for an equitable solution to the tensions that exist between China and the United States. That's a whole different negotiating posture and step, and I don't want to bring it up here, except to point out that you can't do that if you're tangled up in a war in Europe. And left to their own devices, the Europeans apparently were willing to have a war with Russia. That would be problematic for the United States. So how do you resolve this? And again, I want to just once again remind your audience that prior to the meeting in Riyadh between Rubio and Yermak, the presidential advisor to the president of Ukraine, Europe was talking about humbling Russia on the battlefield, that there could be no ceasefire, that this war could only end with a Russian military defeat, and Europe was going to be the one to ensure that defeat occurred. That was the European posture. Then Marco Rubio comes out with Mike Waltz, and they talk about, we've agreed to a 30-day ceasefire. And there are certain conditions that the Ukrainians laid out, but it's a 30-day ceasefire, and the ball is in Russia's court. Those are very important words. Why? because immediately out of every capital in Europe came a following statement, almost word for word. We love the idea of a ceasefire. Wait a minute. Didn't you just say that there can't be a ceasefire? Russia must be humbled militarily, defeated. But now Europe's saying, we love a ceasefire. It's the greatest thing. And the ball is now in Russia's court. They said it. Everybody said the same thing over and over again, which means that this was scripted. What the United States did is trap Europe. That's what happened in Riyadh. It's not about trapping the Russians. Everybody, oh, look, we outflanked the Russians. You never outflank the Russians. How do you outflank somebody named Sergei Lavrov that's been around forever, who's been doing this forever? Vladimir Putin has been the leader of Russia for a quarter of a century. These Russians are better prepared. They know more. They know about themselves. They know about the world. They know about everybody. This is not their first rodeo. This is not their fifth rodeo. This is not their 1,000th rodeo. They invented the frickin' rodeo. And so they, you don't outmaneuver the Russians. But Donald Trump outmaneuvered Europe. Because now Europe is committed to not war, but a ceasefire. Europe has said that is the best outcome. That is the outcome we want, a ceasefire. And the ball is in Russia's court. What's important about that term? It implies a process. I mean, it's a reference to a game. They didn't say, take it or leave it, Russia. No one said that. They said, the ball's in your court. So that's like a tennis thing, you know? They just hit the ball into Russia's court. Now, that ball can either score a point in the match or Russia will volley it back. Game on. And look at what Russia's done. Listen to what Vladimir Putin said. Ceasefire is essential. Essential. We accept a ceasefire. We accept it. They're playing the game. You see what happened there? They're
balls playing the back.
But then they went backhand back and said, but there are conditions. Now, here's the interesting thing about the conditions. They didn't send the ball back into the Ukrainian court because they don't give a damn about the Ukrainians. They didn't send it back into the European court because Europe, frankly speaking, took themselves out of the game the moment they said, we accept the ceasefire. They went to the American court. And the Americans are receiving the Russian statement today, except this isn't the first time they heard this, Nima. It's the second time or the third time they've heard this. Nothing new is being presented to the Americans. Nothing new. And they will make sure that that point's driven home. When, as Putin said, maybe there needs to be a phone call between us and Trump. When you have the president of Russia and the president of the United States speaking on such an important issue, that's bad news for Europe and that's bad news for Ukraine, because the United States is going to agree to most, if not all, of Russia's conditions. Because it's a game we started. We got Ukraine to agree to play the game, and then we got Europe to buy into the rules of the game. Now the Russians are saying, reality-based, because that's the other thing that the Trump administration kept talking about, whether it's Pete Hegseth or whether it was J.D. Vance, whether it's Marco Rubio, whether it's the president himself, that we have to be dealing with the situation as it exists on the ground, the reality of it. And Russia is about to set forth the definition of what reality is. I don't think that this is going to be the last negotiation. But I think this is the most important negotiation. Everything else was a setup for this. The Ukrainians have committed to a process. Europe has bought into the process. Russia agrees to the process. We have a tennis match. And now Russia is sending the ball back. But the player isn't Ukraine. First of all, let's understand the following. Zelensky has been sidelined. The United States humiliated him in Washington, D.C. And then he was in Riyadh, meeting with the crown prince, but he wasn't allowed to be the head of the delegation. He's the problem, not the solution. And right now inside in Kiev, you hear talk now that he's out. He's done. And my guess is that he'll be out of there within 2 weeks. I don't know where he physically is right now. I don't know if he's on the sidelines of the G7 meeting. I don't know if he returned to Kiev, but he can't last long in Kiev. He's been discredited as a leader, humiliated as a leader. And he has once again directly contradicted the United States after a meeting where his negotiating team received information from Marco Rubio about territorial concessions, that this isn't going back to 2014 or 2022. It's dealing with the reality that exists today. And the Ukrainian delegation went, yeah, we understand that. Zelensky came out and said, no, 2014. We get everything back. We get all of Novorossiya, you know, Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, Lugansk, and we get Crimea. That's the only term. He is so far removed from reality, it's not even funny. So he's finished. It's the end of Zelensky. And when Zelensky goes, you're going to see a collapse of Ukraine, political will, social will. And all Russia has to do is keep the game playing until Ukraine gets into a position where they will comply with Russia's demands. And Europe will have no choice but to follow along. This is the game that's being played. It's called diplomacy. It's a masterclass being put on by the Russians. And I believe with the assistance of the United States. Who's not in Moscow right now from the United States? Marco Rubio. Not there. Why? Why isn't the Secretary of State, who has been involved in these negotiations, not present for the most important negotiation? Because he's always been a figurehead. There's somebody else pulling the strings, somebody else calling the shots. And Rubio isn't needed for this. In fact, he's a distraction from this because Rubio has tainted himself with the Ukrainian brush and the European brush. So he's over there now playing with Europe. Well, what happened to the last person who was supposed to be the one leading the efforts and they got sidelined and sent to Europe? His name was Keith Kellogg. You do know that he was fired. He's no longer the special envoy. I'm not saying that Rubio is going to be fired. I'm going to say that Rubio is not going to be a major part of the Russian negotiation going forward. This is now in Donald Trump's hands. Steve Witkoff, although they said he's not going to be the principal negotiator, Steve Witkoff is the facilitator. And he's got this in Trump's hands. And I think that once Trump and Putin nail down the basics, they'll bring in a closer who will come in and close the deal. And that's going to happen in a matter of weeks. I think Zelensky's going to be gone. The Ukrainian government collapses. Now you have the conditions to where Russia can come in and participate in a post-conflict election that gets their man installed, gets a parliament, a Rada installed that's willing to make the constitutional changes that Russia views as a prerequisite for denazification, who will agree to demilitarization on the terms set forth by Russia. And Europe will have no choice but to comply with this. This is what happened in Riyadh. Europe was trapped into a position where a ceasefire is now the primary policy objective, as opposed to humbling Russia, defeating Russia, all the things they were talking about. That's not being talked about now. They're talking about, you know, the necessity of a ceasefire. This is the game. We're moving towards a ceasefire. The conditions that need to be met to make a ceasefire possible.
How do you put the Ukrainian drone attack on Russia in the picture that you're giving us? Who was behind it? Do you think it was all about the Ukrainian government, or we see British government and or British intelligence behind it?
I would imagine that it's a combination of the two. The British have been deeply involved in advising the Ukrainian government on various aspects of their resistance to Russia. The British are behind almost every major effort undertaken by Ukraine, whether it's the attack on the Kerch Bridge, whether it's the Kursk incursion, whether it was the Belgorod incursion before that, whether it was the 2023 summer counteroffensive, whether it was the fall 2022 offensive in Kharkov and elsewhere. The British were behind this. So there's no doubt in my mind that the British advised Ukraine to carry out this attack, to achieve certain psychological impact, to try and get Russia to overreact, to disrupt Russia's ability to respond in a cohesive, coherent manner to the diplomatic challenges that would accrue with the Riyadh meeting. And Russia's shrugged it off. I mean, there will be a response, but it's not going to be the dramatic, 12 Oreshniks obliterating Kiev, slaughtering 100,000 people and destroy the Ukrainian government. Why would Russia destroy the Ukrainian government right now? We're on the verge of taking control of the Ukrainian government. I mean, you got to think strategically here. It makes no sense to have, you know, the psychotic pleasure of revenge when you're winning across the board. Russia's not losing in any aspect of this conflict right now. Yes, Ukraine launched a major attack. The vast majority of those drones were shot down. The ones that weren't did minimal damage, minimal damage. It's tragic for the three Russians who lost their lives and for the other Russians who were injured, for the property owners who suffered damage. Tragic, of course. But Russia's in a conflict. I mean, the population of Sudzha suffered far more than the population of Moscow did. That's where the real insult to Russia took place. Hence Putin's talk about, we can't just let the guys who committed these atrocities get away. There has to be an accounting. But yeah, the British were behind this, but the British, they've got nothing. I mean, that's it. That was their Sunday punch. That was it. There's nothing else they can do.
What's your take on Vladimir Putin putting on military uniform? And we haven't seen this sort of images before. This is the new, a new sort of attitude on the part of Vladimir Putin. Is that related to the Kursk and what's happening in the Kursk region, or is it something beyond that?
I think it's purely related to Kursk. The Russians aren't in the business of sending signals to the West. They don't care about the West. They really don't. I mean, they'll negotiate, but when Russia speaks to the West, they speak bluntly, they speak plainly. There's no need for signals. There's no need to disguise things. Kursk was a major blow to Russia. That was a humiliation to Russia. An embarrassment. And Putin has made it a point that he will resolve the Kursk situation in favor of Russia. And so he is the commander in chief. And as the commander in chief at this critical moment in the Kursk fighting, he's went to visit his field commanders. And he wore a camouflage uniform to make a point that he is a war leader leading a nation at war, even though they call it a special military operation. And that he takes this job very seriously. And it's a reminder to the Russian people, because that's whom he was signaling, that they need to stay on track. Don't get distracted by calls for ceasefire and things of that nature. We were invaded. Our Russian citizens were traumatized, terrorized, murdered, and we have a job to do, and we need to finish this job. And he was very, very tough on how he sees this job being finished. He's treating every single Ukrainian that crossed into Kursk as a terrorist. He said that the prosecution's office had been ordered to prepare prosecutions of every single Ukrainian that traveled, or foreign mercenary, although there won't be a prosecution of the foreign mercenaries, because they'll be killed. He said they have no rights under the Geneva Convention, which means that there'll be a summary trial and a summary execution. If you're a foreigner, don't bother surrendering to the Russians, because you'll just die. Get the hell out if you want to live. But you're dead men walking, literally, because the Russians view you as not just terrorists, but you are the worst vile kind of terrorists, the ones who have no rights. Putin did order his military to treat the terrorists with, you know, humanity, to not torture them, to beat them up, not execute them. But we have seen a photograph out there, or a video actually, of I think five people who are part of a drone unit. They were captured by the Russians. And we saw them alive, bound, and we saw a video of them dead, apparently executed with a bullet to the head. I think they are Georgians, so they're not Ukrainian. Already strike one, you're a foreign mercenary, and you're a drone operator. And the Georgians are horrific, because their job isn't to do principal military support to the Ukrainians. Their job, they're terrorists. There's a reason why the Russians use that term. These are the people that hunt down wounded Russians and blow them up with a drone as sort of a snuff film. They make these movies showing the Russians cowering in fear and hiding and trying to surrender, but they kill them anyways. They show blowing up civilian vehicles, etc. They're committing war crimes and they're documenting it, because that's who they are. Sick, perverse war criminals. And they're not Ukrainian. So when they got captured, they got identified as drone operators. You're in trouble. And there were the evidence of their crimes was right there, because they always record it. So the Russians reviews the evidence, and then they're Georgians. So they're executed. Everybody's going crazy about it right now. Guys, this is serious stuff. If you're a mercenary fighting on the side of Ukraine, you're going to die if the Russians catch you. They're going to kill you, especially if they capture you in Kursk. The Russians are willing to give the Ukrainians the benefit of the doubt. Notice they don't call the Ukrainians who fight in Kherson, Zaporizhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk terrorists, because the Russians, while they view these territories as belonging to Russia, understand that the Ukrainians could feel in their hearts that they're defending their own territory. So they're willing to recognize the legitimacy of the Ukrainian defensive efforts so long as those defensive efforts are linked to legitimate war objectives and not terrorizing civilian populations. But going into Kursk is a totally different matter. Ukraine is not at war with Russia. They haven't declared war against Russia. So this conflict should be limited to the special military operations zone of operations. Ukraine made a decision to invade Kursk, which is not part of the new Russia. It's part of ancient Russia. It's sacred territory, by the way, 1943, the major tank battles. This is the symbolism of this is as evident to all. But they don't get the benefit of the doubt. These aren't military soldiers carrying out military orders. They have invaded Russia in violation of Russian law. There is no declaration of war, which makes them terrorists by definition. And Russia will treat them as such. So that's what's happening. I think it was important for Putin to wear this uniform to remind the Russian people that they are still in a conflict. This conflict has existential proportions attached to it, and that the conflict isn't going to end overnight, that there will be more sacrifices that need to be made before victory can be achieved. But the Russian people can go to bed at night safe in the certainty of a Russian victory. And that's why Putin wore camouflage.
He's one of the main concerns that he has mentioned in his response was how can we manage that Ukrainians are not going to rearm and regroup during the 30-day ceasefire, which we know that part of this is related to the United States. They said right after the agreement between the United States and Ukraine, they said they're going to resume providing Ukraine with arms and I don't know with intelligence. The way that Putin is picturing the situation is related to the United States and the way that they're trying to support Ukrainians. How is that going to play out in your opinion?
Well, first of all, I think we need to be careful about drawing too much inference to the decision by the United States previously to suspend the delivery of military aid and suspend intelligence. This was not a Russian precondition. Russia did not set that objective in their initial talks. This was a unilateral action by the United States to punish Zelensky for his failure to negotiate in good faith. And when Zelensky apologized and the Ukrainians looked as if they were going to negotiate in good faith, the United States lifted those restrictions. But this isn't about the United States betraying Russia or stabbing Russia in the back. Not at all. Just the opposite. The United States is simply putting pressure on Ukraine. But there will have to be a formal agreement. One of the things the Russians have said that is we no longer go off of handshakes and partial agreements or incomplete agreements, that whatever agreement we have is going to have to be spelled out in writing and take the form of a treaty that's enforceable. And that means, and again, Putin alluded to it, if you're going to have a treaty, what's your verification? How do you verify compliance? Or if there are allegations of non-compliance, how do you verify that? What mechanisms are going to be in place? You can't have a ceasefire unless you have, you know, verification measures in place. This has to be discussed. And this has to be done in writing. It has to be done legally in the form of a treaty. And so, you know, that's the direction we're headed here. The Russians are simply reiterating a reality to the Americans. The Americans know, because Russia's always said this. Lavrov has been saying, the day of Minsk 1, Minsk 2, and things like that is over. We don't trust. Putin has admonished himself, saying he was naive and believing in the West's willingness to abide by Minsk. It now turns out the West was using Minsk as a cover to rearm Ukraine to NATO standards. Huh. So you're saying that the precedent is that the West will agree to a ceasefire and then say that conditions will be imposed, but they'll never impose them. And then the ceasefire is simply a cover to buy time to rebuild the Ukrainian army. Do you understand the root cause of the concern for Russia? Because they've done this before, three times. And each time they're lied to. And each time the Ukrainians take advantage of the pause to rearm and attack Russia. That will never happen again. And so Russia will ensure that before there is a ceasefire, there will be certain conditions that have to be met in writing, and they are enforceable conditions, and there has to be an agreed upon mechanism of monitoring and enforcement. It's not going to include NATO. It'll have to be something else agreed upon. But these are conversations that haven't yet happened in detail. And I think what's going to happen is Russia is going to set the table, so to speak, with its, you know, requirement of what has to happen. Then Trump is going to give instructions to go in and fill the gaps in, to put food on the plates, you know, so that a feast can occur. But there has to be a written agreement of great detail. And the Russians set that standard when they submitted on December 17th, I believe, 2021, draft treaties, both the United States and NATO. Setting forth Russia's desire for and conditions in support of seeking a new European security framework. So I just think that, you know, we're getting a reality check from the Russians, and that's okay, because I think the Trump administration was expecting this, was wanting this, and I think they will work with the Russians to move this process forward.
Do you think that, because let's put it this way, Vladimir Putin has said that he's not going to confuse the talks on Ukraine with the situation of they're having with NATO. What does that mean? It seems that the details of what's going on in Ukraine is much more important right now than after a Ukrainian settlement, they're going to talk about NATO. How, because as we know, these two cases are totally connected with each other. Why is he talking this way, in your opinion?
Because there is no connection with the future of NATO and Ukraine. Never has been. It's a made-up issue. When the conflict started, NATO wasn't on the table. It was about NATO expansion, but it wasn't about the existence of NATO, the future of NATO. The Russians did, in their draft treaty, talk about NATO withdrawing its military aspects of it down to the, you know, pre-1997 line. But that was a negotiating position, not a demand. And it's never been included in any of the prerequisites set by Russia regarding, you know, bringing a ceasefire and a termination of conflict. So this is a Western construct that buys into a narrative that says that Putin's seeking it to destroy Europe, destroy NATO, and occupy Europe, to make NATO weak, to make Europe weak. But Russia hasn't articulated this at all. It's not part of the Russian negotiating posture. Even in the December 2021 documents, Russia didn't make demands on NATO other than, you know, to pull the military capacity back to 1997 lines. But they didn't talk about the dismantling of NATO, the end of NATO, the termination of NATO. Oh, Russia acknowledges that NATO exists and that it's a reality that Russia has to deal with. But there is no linkage whatsoever between the conflict resolution in Ukraine and the future of NATO.
How do you see the case of British government being involved in Odessa? It seems that they're trying to manage the situation in Odessa in favor of Ukraine. I don't know, to provide weapons to Ukrainians. How do you see that? Is that going to be problematic to remove them? How much of leverage does the Trump administration have to put pressure on the United Kingdom?
Well, I mean, the UK has already agreed. Their prime minister has agreed that a ceasefire is in the strategic interest of everybody. So that's the strategic direction that they've committed to, is achieving a ceasefire. You know, Britain's role in Odessa is related to, you know, its desire to make Ukraine better positioned to defend itself against Russia by carrying out selective offensive strike operations using suicide drones on the air and sea. using guided missiles, the Scalp, the Storm Shadow, against Crimea, the Kerch Bridge, etc. The British have led a charge in this direction. And, you know, a key aspect of a ceasefire agreement will be removing NATO from Ukrainian soil. And this can only be done at the insistence of the Ukrainian government. And since the Zelensky government has invited them in there and doesn't want to see them go, this, the implication is, in order to get Britain to decouple from Odessa and that region, there will have to be a treaty in writing that commits to that outcome. And I think that's the direction we're heading. I think we're going to see the final agreement come in the form of a very thick, well, not that thick, but a substantial treaty-like document, because there are, you know, in addition to security guarantees, there are things happening that have to survive in perpetuity. And that one of those is the Russians are insisting that NATO, Europe, the United States recognize the four territories of Novorossiya as being part of Russia, that this isn't going to become a Cold War type scenario where every map made in the United States and Europe had the Baltic nations in different colors and calling them occupied Latvia, occupied Lithuania, occupied Estonia. The Russians don't want future maps to say occupied Crimea and, you know, occupied Kherson, Zaporizhzhia, Donetsk, and Lugansk. Russia wants these territories to be recognized by Ukraine and Europe as being constitutionally and legally part of Russia. You know, things of this nature, this stuff has to be agreed to in writing, and there have to be, you know, assurances that are given, and there has to be an enforcement mechanism. All this has to be worked out. See, Russia didn't say no to a ceasefire. They simply volleyed the ball back and redefined the game.
But it doesn't seem that much of a difference, Scott, by the way. The main questions are still there. How the details are much more important than the name that you put it on.
Well, details have been already decided for the most part. I mean, you know, you go with foundational, you know, starting points. No to NATO. How much more detail do you need than that? Because whatever happens has to fall back on no to NATO. So you've already, you know, started defining the four corners of whatever the agreement is going to be. No to NATO. No peacekeepers on the ground. No NATO peacekeepers. How much more detail do you need than that? Niet means niet. You know, we can go on and on and on. I don't think this is going to be as complicated or as hard as people think it's going to be. It's actually very simple. The Russians have put forward some very basic reality-based conditions. When Zelensky is removed from power in the next week or two, the new Ukrainian government will be better positioned to acknowledge not only the legitimacy of the Russian argument, but to act in a manner which codifies the Russian terms in a treaty format that's binding on all parties. That's just the direction I see this happening, because Ukraine is not going to survive much longer on the battlefield. The collapse of the Kursk salient is just the first of many collapses that will take place. Vladimir Putin alluded to it. He said, we are ready to surround major units in eastern Ukraine. And left to their own devices, if this war doesn't grind to an end, you're going to see Russia, you know, put action to match those words. The goal here would be to get a lasting ceasefire and a permanent peace agreed to without Russia having to head down that path. Because once you commit to a fight, we see the difficulty in Kursk. You know, to throw out the concept of a ceasefire in the closing moments of a battle, that if you don't finish the job, you might as well not have fought the battle. Russia needs to finish the job. You know, before they can get into some sort of negotiated settlement. And that's what Putin's saying. And the longer you wait on the east, the more you're going to get similar conditions set up there. You know, let's say the Russians surround the 3rd Assault Brigade. You know, the Azov, you know, the Azov movement's great, you know, successor to the defenders of Mariupol. They have them surrounded. Are they going to agree to a ceasefire that says, and you got to let them go? You got to unsurround them and all this. It'd be difficult. I think we're, you know, going to see pressure being put on Ukraine to accept Russia's terms in the next week or so.
It seems that one of the main concerns on the part of Russia is the connection between the Ukrainian president and the British government or British intelligence. If we assume they're going to replace Zelensky, who's going to be the next president of Ukraine? I would assume that could be Zaluzhny, who is prepared by the British intelligence for the job. Is that going to be solved? Is that going to be less problematic for Russia? Is that going to change the policies? Here comes the new cycle of chaos coming to Ukraine in the eyes of Russians.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not privy to Russian thinking on this. I would have a hard time seeing Russia accept Zaluzhny as anything other than an interim negotiating partner, that the permanent peace will be done by somebody who is committed to the Russian point of view. This is why they have a guy, Medvedchuk, who's in Russia right now, former Ukrainian parliamentarian, who was arrested and beaten badly by the Zelensky government in the opening days and weeks of the special military operation, but was eventually traded to Russia in exchange for the Azov prisoners that Russia had held, they captured, and were going to subject them to potential life sentences for the crimes that they had committed. Instead, they were released to Turkish custody and eventually released back to Ukrainian custody. That shows you the importance that Russia attaches to this this Ukrainian politician. And I think that Russia's strategic objective is to get Medvedchuk or somebody like him installed as the president of Ukraine, who governs Ukraine in a post-conflict reality, as opposed to allowing, you know, NATO tainted personnel to remain. I don't think Russia is going to do that. Zaluzhny just isn't he's not the solution. He's the problem. He is. So no, I don't think Zaluzhny is going to be part of Ukraine going forward in a post-conflict environment. He may have a useful purpose as an interim leader, similar to the role played by Admiral Donitz at the end of the Second World War, when Adolf Hitler committed suicide. This German admiral became the head of state and managed the last moments of Nazi Germany. I could see Zaluzhny being brought in to manage the last moments of Nazi Ukraine, but ultimately he will have to step aside and maybe even stand trial for what he has done.
How about the contracts between the British government and Ukraine? Are they going to be valid in the eyes of Trump and his administration?
You're asking the wrong question. There's only one question. Are they going to be valid in the eyes of Russia?
Yeah.
That's the only one that counts. And the answer is no. So Russia doesn't care.
But at the end of the day, it's Donald Trump who's going to deal with the issue in the West.
Doesn't matter. Reality. Trump just can't come in and say, Trump, first of all, is signing a deal with the Ukrainians that I think overlaps on the British deal. So it's not just the Russians are saying, the British deal no longer has me. Trump's going to be saying the same thing. The difference is that Trump is talking with the Russians via Kirill Dmitriev about a broader economic cooperation that could include the United States helping Russia exploit its $7 trillion worth of rare earth minerals. So I think Russia is more inclined to be supportive of the American posturing when it comes to the resources of Ukraine than they will be with with the British, who just went out and negotiated without coordinating with anybody. It's still a secret agreement. We don't know exactly what was agreed to. But I will tell you this, that it has no weight under international law, and it will be unenforceable. And the British will never see that contract brought to fruition, because between the United States and Russia, that contract will be declared null and void.
How, when it comes to NATO, right now, Donald Trump is talking with the Secretary General of NATO. And we know that France and the United Kingdom, they have been, they are trying to reorganize their defense spending by bypassing NATO and making direct deals between the two. How is that going to influence NATO and the future of NATO? Are they getting to the point that they're perceiving that NATO is not going to work in a long run for us? Let's go find some other solutions.
Well, first of all, let's just be realistic here. When we speak of NATO funding, we're not talking about the defense budgets of the sovereign states. That's not NATO funding. NATO funding is the percentage of national treasury that is allocated to each nation to keep NATO functioning civilly. NATO has a number of civil programs to keep the secretariat functioning, keep the pay the salary of NATO employees. And then certain costs that are associated with shared military spending, to ensure that there's compatibility, et cetera. But NATO doesn't buy tanks. NATO doesn't buy aircraft. NATO doesn't buy artillery pieces. NATO doesn't buy artillery shells. That's the responsibility of sovereign states. And so whatever scheme the British and the French are cooking up, it's not bypassing NATO. NATO was never involved in it. This is a unilateral decision made by the two nations independent of NATO. So I don't want to read too much into that decision making, but I do want to point out that the methodology being considered by Europe to borrow from itself 800 billion euro, there is a precedent in the last 2 years of this model, and it's not a good model. The Germans in 2022 talked about spending 100 billion euro to a one-time expenditure to get the German army up out of the doldrums, become this lethal fighting force. But maybe they should have consulted with an accountant beforehand, because my understanding is that the Germans borrowed this money from themselves at a 14% interest rate. And almost immediately upon having that money allocated, they had to begin making interest rate payments. And by the end of the first year, without any weapons being procured, they were down to about between 50 and 60 billion euros that were usable. The rest was already allocated to pay back the loan, the interest rates, etc. And the longer they go with this, the more the purchasing power shrinks. This is what's going to happen. It's not 800 billion euro. If you're dealing with a 14% interest rate, whatever the, I think that's the loan terms that they're talking about. This 800 billion is going to be reduced to 620 billion right off the bat, drop it down to maybe a little over 500 billion by the time, fall year's end comes around. So it ain't 800 billion. It's going to be significantly less than that. And again, the expense of carrying this European-only arsenal, they're going to be paying premium prices for this. There won't be discounts. And at the end of the day, nothing's going to happen that's positive. In fact, it will make Europe weaker, just like Germany became weaker by allocating this $100 billion, because the $100 billion didn't accomplish anything. I've used this analogy before, but I'll use it again. If I have $20,000 and I want to make investments in my home's 50 years old, could use a new roof, could use get rid of that 50-year-old linoleum in the kitchen and maybe put down some nice tiles. The windows, we got 50-year-old windows, which means there's a lot of leaking inefficiency there. We'd like to replace those. So we have these, this 20,000, and we want to use it to bring our home up to speed. But what happens if, since this house was built in the mid-1980s, in the interim time, I didn't maintain it? Let's say I didn't have good gutters, and came down and the water got in and compromised my foundation. So the foundation is now cracking. And maybe there was a leak in the upstairs bathroom that got into the ceiling, but I didn't repair that properly. I just plastered it over, and now I got black mold that's all over my house. It's gotten into everything. What happens when, if I didn't clean out my my hot air, my HVAC system, and all these pipes now, all these, tubes that are going around pushing air in there, instead of, being clean, it's just a festering, seething pool of bacteria, dead tissue, and everything that builds up over 50 years and just spewing poison in the air. You think my 20,000 is going to cover that? What happens when I begin to initiate the renovations necessary to take care of a fundamentally deficient home? And I start tearing out the ceiling, tearing out the roof. And so I've torn down the house, and now I bring my 20 grand, and it doesn't even begin to start. It's done in a week. And all I have now is a torn up house and broken. This is what's going to happen to Europe. You see, Europe, NATO, was constructed with the Cold War in mind. All of the infrastructure for NATO goes back to justifications that were created during the Cold War to justify large standing armies ready on a moment's notice to respond to a Soviet incursion, to go from zero to 60 in a, in a blink of an eye, 24/7, every day of the year. Then the Cold War ended, and the justification for that went away. So what did they do? They stopped maintaining their armies. Their armies aren't ready to fight at a moment's notice. They took them to the garrison. There was no more training for high-intensity land warfare, because that was supposed to be a thing of the past. But they maintained this infrastructure, this architecture. But instead of being, cutting edge, ready to fight a war, it became a sinecure. This is where people came to retire. You went to NATO for a career. And you got involved in the logistics groups, and you got involved in think tanks, and you got involved in conceptualizing a new role for NATO in the world today. You're doing everything but preparing to fight a war. Your troops are confined to barracks. You stop doing bayonet training. Hell, you stop doing any meaningful training at all. Your tanks stay in because you're not going to fight large-scale tank warfare. There's no reason to bring 54 tanks out on the Grafenwöhr battlefield to work on getting battalions to cooperate with battalions. You may bring out 14 tanks to work with an infantry battalion in a peacekeeping scenario that was replicated, that you saw play out in Yugoslavia. But that's it. That's not high-intensity conflict. You worry more about medical evacuation than you do about closing with and destroying the enemy through firepower maneuver. You lose your focus. You lose your edge. And that's where NATO is today. It is the crumbling house. It isn't the well-maintained house like mine is. Knock on wood. Oops. Should have knocked. Got my dogs on. I'm excited. But, bad move, Ritter. But the fact is... NATO is this decrepit building that hasn't been maintained. You're not going to take, see, these people are thinking, all I need to do is get $800 billion in and I will get it back up to where it was. Well, that's like me, pre-COVID. I was in the gym every day, 5 days a week, playing basketball 3 days a week, boxing 3 days a week. I was in good shape for an old man. And yet, I hit the couch. After post-COVID, I'm doing a little bit here and there, but ain't what it was. And this is like me saying, if I just go to the gym twice a week, I'll be right back where I was. I don't need to do everything. I just need to top it off a little bit. Are you kidding? If I go to the gym twice a week, all I'm going to do is break my body down that hasn't been training. It'll make things worse unless I'm willing to do everything, but they're not willing to do it. $800 billion will solve nothing. I told you, $100 billion the Germans put into their military, and they were weaker at the end than they were going in. When they put that $100 billion out there, they were stronger. By the time they finished that $100 billion spent, they're weaker because they started projects they couldn't finish. It didn't solve any of the underlying problems. And now you want to do the same thing to NATO, generate $800 billion. It's a loan to yourself. You have to violate every economic principle to generate this money. And as soon as you raise it, you have to start paying it back, paying the interest on it. And what are you doing? You're not fixing anything. Nothing's fixed. I mean, I love people. Europe's going to begin building its own airplanes. Really? What's the world-changing sixth-generation European fighter? You don't have one. And you can't build one either. Sorry, your air industries aren't. That's why you're buying the F-16s and the F-18s and the F-35s. That's why you're not buying anything else other than that, with some minor exceptions. Tanks? They don't have tanks. They don't even know what a tank is anymore. Tank is just this rolling metal coffin. They don't know how to build tanks if tanks aren't able to fight and survive in a modern warfare. Same thing with infantry fighting. Communications. They have not been preparing for actual combat communications. Do they know how to communicate in combat? You know who does? The Russians and the Ukrainians. They do it because they... Oh, telling people they can't call me. NATO can't do any of this, and $800 billion isn't going to get them anywhere, especially if the Europeans are talking about simultaneously maintaining NATO and this new European security arrangement. So, yep, that's where it is. Unfortunately, we are going to have to go. I only allocated an hour for this interview, so okay. We're going to have to wrap it up.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much, Scott, for being with us today. Great pleasure.
Thanks a lot. We'll continue the conversation later.
Okay. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.